The Guardian.
I'm James Randerson, and this is Science Weekly for the 11th of August. Coming up, we discuss the end of the world with our special guest, disaster expert Bill Maguire. Also in the podcast.
Well, I think it's the most exciting moment in my career as a physicist, and I've seen plenty of accelerators come and go.
The greatest experiment on Earth will soon be underway. Plus, primates on the brink, using pollen to catch criminals, and the bizarre tale of a woman who cloned her pet pit bull terrier. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, even more so than usual, we've decided to reach for the extreme limits of human prowess and emulate the Olympians doing battle this week in Beijing. As ever, no expense has been spared to recreate the Olympic atmosphere here in the pod. So there's a big picture of Chairman Mao on the wall, carbon monoxide fumes are being pumped in as we speak, and any criticism of the regime, that's me, will be cut from the show. After a long absence, it's a great pleasure to welcome The Guardian's environment correspondent, David Adam, back into the pod. Are you feeling close to the pinnacle of human endeavour, David?
Certainly at base camp, James, I think, yes.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. And also limbering up is BA Media Fellow Marcus Pearce of Goldsmiths, University of London.
Hello, James.
Thanks for joining us. But our special guest this week is Professor Bill Maguire. He runs the Benfield Hazard Research Centre at University College London and is a world expert on geological and climatological disasters. Bill's books include Apocalypse, A Natural History of Global Disaster, Raging Planet, Earthquakes, Volcanoes and the Tectonic Threat to Life on Earth, Global Catastrophes, and Surviving Armageddon, Solutions for a Threatened Planet. Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
What a depressing list that is.
I was going to say, how do you get up in the morning? It must be awful. You've got razor blades by the side of the blade.
Yeah, well, it's a sort of human condition, isn't it? You know that there are these threats out there, and particularly climate change that we're going to talk about. But you know, in your head, you don't think you still don't think it's going to happen to you. And so I can get out of bed and I can smile occasionally.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
In fact, I was told by a TV producer I had the wrong sort of face for writing and talking about catastrophes. They wanted somebody much gloomier looking, really.
Oh, right. Well, stop smiling right now. Your latest book, I have to say, is, well, it's kind of in a similar vein, but with there's perhaps an upbeat edge to the title, 7 Years to Save the Planet. Explain the 7 years, because there's been a lot of talk at the moment about 100 months to save the planet, which isn't quite 7 years. What's the difference?
Well, 100 months, 7 years, I don't think a few months between friends is anything really. But the idea is that in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's fourth assessment report that came out in 2007, they said if we want to bring emissions down to by 50 to 80% by the mid-century, then we will need to stabilise emissions by 2015, and they'll have to fall after that. So effectively, although emissions are accelerating at the moment, they have to get to the high point within 5 years, and then they need to start to drop then. The big problem is that the latest science says maybe even a 90% cut in emissions by 2050 won't be enough. So, you know, 7 years may, you know, we may already be too late, to be honest.
I wanted to read out one little section from the book. Emissions can only be brought under control in time if every government, business and individual accepts responsibility for their actions and takes up the challenge to create a low-carbon world. Reducing emissions must take precedence over economic growth. If it does not, then 30, 50 or 100 years from now, the world economy may no longer exist in any coherent and recognisable form. That's a huge ask you're making there, so trying to tell people these things have to happen and take precedence over economic growth. Do you really see that's going to happen?
Well, I see the only solution to climate change being a war footing, if you like. And if we look at how, for example, the United States transformed its economy towards fighting the Second World War within a few years from depression, that can be done. And the message I'm trying to get across here is we have to do that. We have no alternative because there will not be any functioning economy if we don't. I mean, Nick Stern in his report on the economics of climate change said that if we don't spend 1% of GDP on tackling climate change, we will at least return to the sort of 1930s depression or World War sort of chaos. Now he says we need to spend 2% of GDP, I think his latest estimate. That's about $1.4 trillion a year, on my reckoning, which we're certainly not doing. And the longer that goes on, so that idea of, you know, return to the 30s depression gets worse and worse and worse, to be honest. And 2050, and even earlier than that, is going to be a very, very bad time for everyone. I've got a 4-year-old son, and he's going to have a much harder life than I have.
David Adam, you're the Guardian's resident doom monger. What do you think?
Well, it's hard to disagree, really. I suppose the only point I just like to bring up is Bill, you raised this idea of saving the planet. What's that predicated on? Is that a 2-degree rise that most people talk about?
There's this sort of arbitrary definition, isn't there, of dangerous climate change, which I think consensus suggests is what we would see if the temperatures went above 2 degrees C, above pre-industrial levels. So I'm really focusing on trying to prevent dangerous climate change. That's what the book's really getting at. And that's what the 7 years is about, because the IPCC say the same thing. To avoid dangerous climate change, we need this 50 to 80% cut in emissions by 2050. But as I said, even 90% may not be enough. So we really need a zero carbon world by mid-century. That's the ask, and that is an incredible ask, as you say, but what's the alternative?
Because there are two things I would say to that. One is that nobody serious that I talk to believes we can still do it at 2 degrees. That we can stabilise the world at 2 degrees. If you look at the International Energy Agency estimates, just for the amount of coal that we're going to burn over the next 2 decades, that would do it by itself. And so my first question to you is, aren't you essentially wasting your time with that very narrow definition? And secondly, doesn't it create the idea that this is a binary outcome, that we either save the world or we don't, and if we don't, then all hell breaks loose? Whereas actually, it's a sliding scale, and if we're not going to get 2 degrees, then 3 degrees is an awful lot better than 4 degrees, and 4 degrees is an awful lot better than 6 or 7 degrees. And so, it's not like you can save the world at any point, but you can stop it sliding into worse and worse and worse conditions. And so, there isn't a point at which we give up and say, right, that's it, the world is no longer saved.
No, absolutely. I mean, I don't want to give the impression that, I'm saying this is a safe limit. If we don't achieve that, then we might as well, not bother. That clearly isn't the case. It is a sliding scale, as you say. But the danger is that sliding scale has tipping points along the way. So it's not linear. I mean, if we go to 3 or 4 degrees, we almost certainly will lose the Greenland ice sheet. And then big parts of West Antarctica, for example. So you could go then from sort of sea level rise by a few tens of centimetres to guaranteeing a sea level rise of maybe 10 metres, perhaps in 300 years. Now that will bring about a world which is transformed from what we know today. So saving the planet as we know it is what I'm trying to say. We need action now to do that. And you mentioned the International Energy Agency. Some of their figures are pretty dodgy, to be honest. You need to take account of other people's views. I noticed their forecast for oil is that in 2030, they say demand for oil will be 113 million barrels a day, whereas, for example, one of the groups that assess how much oil is still in the ground, how much we've got, Energy Watch, says that we'll have achieved peak oil way before that, and that the output will be 30 million barrels a day. So that's a lot better for climate change, but it's a lot worse for complete economic disaster.
This discussion over 2, 3, 4, etc. degrees, where are we going to be at? Was sort of brought alive this week by Bob Watson, the chief scientist at the UK government's environment department, because he was saying he came out and said, we have to prepare for 4 degrees, even though obviously the EU target is 2 degrees, but lots of people think that's not achievable. I mean, some people. When I talked to them about this story, suggested that even him saying that came across as a bit defeatist and was almost trading mitigation, i.e. preventing it from happening, for adaptation, or throwing in the towel and saying, well, sod it, we're just going to have to live with it. Do you think it's defeatist to even talk about it?
I read the piece. It's very difficult to know where to stand on this, because I do understand the idea that if you get into this mindset, 2 degrees isn't that really that crucial, then you can say, well, let's try for 3 or whatever. But on the other hand, we are probably going to see 2 degrees C rise or more, and therefore we do have to adapt to some degree. But the worry is that if we see a 4 degrees C rise, I think most climate scientists would suggest that we would lose the Greenland ice sheet. So what are you adapting to with a 4 degree rise? Are you adapting to the flooding of every coastal town and city on the planet? How do you adapt to that? I mean, it's a very difficult situation.
Well, let's leave that one there for now, but we'll come back to you a bit later, Bill. And if you haven't all slit your wrists out there, you're welcome to add your thoughts to the blog. I'm James Randerson, and you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come...
We have substantial evidence that our soil samples contain perchlorate.
Another unexpected find on Mars. We ask whether NASA's Phoenix lander is close to sniffing out life. First, though,
News Jam.
By the magic of podcasting, Ian Sample has joined us in the pod. Hello, Ian.
Hi there.
And now for our roundup of some of the other science and technology stories making the news over the past 7 days. Here's Ian and Marcus with your News Jam.
Nearly half of all primate species are now threatened with extinction, according to an evaluation by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. The study is the most comprehensive analysis for more than a decade. It found that the conservation outlook for monkeys, apes and other primates has dramatically worsened. The main threats are habitat destruction and the bushmeat trade.
An American woman has received 5 puppies that were cloned from her late pit bull, Booger. She's the inaugural customer of a South Korean company, RNL Bio, that says it is the world's first successful commercial canine cloning service. It is working with a team of Seoul National University scientists who created the world's first cloned dog in 2005.
Pollen could be used to identify the perpetrators of gun crimes. The microscopic grains can be coated onto bullets during manufacture and are sticky enough to hold on even after the gun has been fired. Each nanotag is made up of pollen and a unique chemical signature that can be used to identify the batch of ammunition.
And finally, humans may not be the only ones to find yawning contagious. According to researchers at Birkbeck, University of London, a yawn is likely to set off pets as well as those around you. Psychologists found that dogs were far more likely to break into a yawn if they witnessed humans simulating the action.
News Jam.
Thank you, Marcus and Ian. I'm feeling a little bit sleepy myself, I must say. So wake me up, Ian. Primates, it's kind of easy to get extinction fatigue in a way. I mean, it's such a terrible story every time you report on it, or every time anyone reports on it, but what's new here?
It is, and well, this is the most sort of comprehensive study that's been done in an awful long time by the IUCN, looking at the sort of how primate species are faring around the world. And, you know, some of the numbers here are just astounding. And you say, we write about these things an awful lot of the time, and you do get a bit fatigued about these figures because there's, you know, the message seems to be the same, that species being pushed to the brink. But, you know, these numbers just have to be shocking. I mean, in Asia, you're talking about, you know, more than 70% of some of these primate species being you know, in the some of the highest risk groups that you've got. And I think after reading this story, you're just left wondering what is there actually that people can do, because obviously, you know, the habitat is being destroyed because people want to use that land for farming and such like. The meat is being hunted and eaten. You know, who are we to go in there and tell people to change things? But also, you know, what do you do to preserve these animals? So I don't know. I mean, what are your views on that?
Well, I thought it was quite striking that the area of the world where the picture is worst in Asia is kind of the area of the world where economically things are going best, and that people are being brought out of poverty. And so it really, it brings a kind of horrible message in a way that you know, either you keep people poor like in Africa and okay, the primate's not doing great, but they're doing better than anywhere else, or, you know, once people start to use resources and start to chop down their forests, as in Asia, then things are really dire. I mean, there were one or two rays of hope. The golden lion tamarin and the black lion tamarin in Brazil have crept up from being critically endangered to just being endangered. But those kind of success stories were few and far between, weren't they?
But are there not programs in place, though, to encourage sort of local populations to see these as an asset and to almost use them and preserve them as a money-making scheme in some sense for attract tourism or what have you? And I would have wondered whether in the more developed areas, perhaps that would have been embraced a lot more. So maybe in some of these parts of Southeast Asia, maybe they would have been more clued up to that, or more you know, have the infrastructure to be able to deal with tourists coming in and such like that. I wondered if actually the problems would get better there as they came out of poverty and got more developed.
Doesn't look that way. Marcus, what do you think? I mean, do you think that the public, when they listen to these kind of stories, just almost kind of switch off because, you know, you hear these sort of devastating numbers so often?
There's possibly a risk of that. There's also, I mean, in this case, that it was such a wide-ranging survey. I mean, things like chimpanzees and maybe bonobos or gorillas, you know, the public can probably resonate with, but there's so many sort of species of monkey there that, I mean, perhaps it is just overwhelming.
Well, moving on to a very different story, Booger, or is it Booger? Anyone who... we're British, we don't know how to pronounce that. So if you can tell us on the blog, that'd be great. But Ian, tell us, there's a bit more to this story than just meets the eye, isn't there?
There's an awful lot more to this story, actually, and it's a story I can barely believe. So we obviously got the news that Bernan McKinney, the woman, had her late pit bull cloned and had five puppies.
The previous
pit bull, Booga, dying from cancer in 2006, I think it was. Now, what's amazing is Bernard McKinney is actually the same person as Joyce McKinney, who was a beauty queen. And in she kind of made the news in 1977 over here because she came to the country and came to the south of the country, to Surrey, with a private investigator in search of a guy called Kirk Anderson, who was a Mormon preacher, essentially, who had come over to do his works, I suppose. He was kidnapped at gunpoint and chloroformed by Joyce McKinney, taken off to a cottage in Devon, chained to the bed and required to have repeated sex before escaping. Now,
did Stephen King get involved in this?
I think that's maybe where the idea for Misery came from. And obviously it's not funny, it's deeply serious. Joyce McKinney was charged with false imprisonment and owning an imitation .38 revolver. She was remanded in custody at Holloway, but skipped bail. And her and the fellow she was travelling with headed for Canada, disguised as mute mime artists.
And I'm sorry, I'm laughing. You just can't make this up.
No,
it's utterly bizarre.
Well, the icing on the cake is that in 93, I mean, it's not as if she sort of evaded the law since going back to North America. She in 93, she broke into a dog pound in Tennessee, where she actually rescued, disturbingly, a pit bull terrier, which was due to be put down because it had mauled some passing joggers. So as Ian Cobain in The Guardian last week said, we have the prospect that these five cloned puppies may actually be the cloned descendants of a dog that itself was facing the death penalty for harming humans. And it just shows that it's worth making a few phone calls when a story comes out.
I think we've got to leave that one there. There's no more one can say on that subject. Just a little bit of any other business. The Guardian hosted last week a comment piece by Arthur Scargill, who is a kind of emblematic figure from the 80s, I suppose, who did battle with a union leader in the coal industry, who did battle with Thatcher over coal. Now, he challenged our very own George Monbiot to prove which is more dangerous, coal energy or nuclear energy, and he said he would prefer to sit in a room full of CO2 for 2 minutes if George Monbiot would sit in a room full of radiation for 2 minutes. I just don't quite know where to start, Ian.
No, I mean, as one of our colleagues in the newsroom said a few moments ago, it's like trying to settle the Middle East problems with a hand with an arm wrestle. It's so, I don't know where to start with it. I'll be interested if our readers have any thoughts on this.
I kind of head in hands. I've no idea really.
Yeah, it's a shameful moment for us, and we're sorry.
Well, I think we better wrap it up there. If you have any thoughts, please head to the blog or the Facebook page.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
2 weeks ago, there was the excitement of finding water on the surface of Mars. Again. Now NASA's Phoenix lander has made another discovery. Here's Peter Smith at the University of Arizona, who is chief scientist for the Phoenix mission, on why NASA took the unusual step of releasing the findings so soon.
The Phoenix project has decided to take an unusual step and break with scientific tradition that has been followed for many years. Today we're opening a window into the project to allow the public to see our scientific process in action. Tradition has been bypassed because of the extreme interest that has been exhibited towards Phoenix. Rather than the speculation that has become rampant in the web, I promise you insight into the investigations that are underway inside the Operations Center. We are still at the stage where multiple hypotheses are being examined, but even so, we have substantial evidence that our soil samples contain perchlorates. That's carbon with four oxygens. Chlorine. I can't read my own writing. As chlorine with four oxygens. These compounds are quite stable in soil and water and do not destroy organic materials under normal circumstances. In fact, there are species of perchlorate-reducing microbes that live on the energy provided by this oxidant. Therefore, this is an important piece in the puzzle as we attempt to determine whether habitable conditions exist for microbes on Mars.
So even eminent NASA scientists can sometimes get a bit confused about their chemistry. Marcus, you've been following this perchlorate story. Just give us, flesh out the details a little bit. What's it doing there?
Well, what happened was that that there were various rumours going around. They found something that meant that life was impossible on Mars. And these rumours were flying around and gathering weight. So they decided to make a new statement, which they said was an unusual step.
But what are the nuts and bolts of what they've actually found?
What they've actually found are perchlorate salts, which don't really have any implications for whether there is or isn't life on Mars, but they have implications for what kind of life might be on Mars.
But is there also an issue about potential contamination here?
That was a question raised because perchlorates are used in as oxidising agents in fuel, but apparently not on the Phoenix lander, although they were used in one of the stages of boosting. So they could have been transported to Mars on the Phoenix lander, and that's something that apparently they were still looking into. So this is kind of an intermediate result.
Bill, I mean, the scientific tradition here that they were talking about breaking or have broken, I suppose, is by going public with the results before peer review and publication in an eminent journal and all that kind of thing. And that's held dear by scientists for all sorts of reasons, and us journalists get rapped on the knuckles when we encourage people to break that tradition. Do you think in this case it was a good idea, or have they sort of slightly jumped the gun?
No, I think there are situations where you have to explain what your findings are, if it's causing a problem, as you were mentioning, you know, with rumours of life or whatever. And you know, in my area, we sometimes have this problem. If, for example, we're monitoring a volcano, if we're measuring ground deformation or something, and we see that we're getting significant swelling, which might, you know, suggest that an eruption's on its way, well, we can't sort of sit around writing a paper and submitting it to a journal or whatever.
Because 8 months later.
Exactly. By the time it comes out, you know, there's still 100,000 dead or something. So, you know, we would have to inform the authorities. So there are... Clearly, there are circumstances like that where you have to go public, I think.
Well, you could always inform The Guardian next time, and we could inform the authorities via the front page.
Or better still, I could write the article for The Guardian and get paid.
No. That doesn't happen. Sorry about that. Well, thanks, everyone. And to keep up with the latest news from Mars, check out guardian.co.uk/science. Now, it is the most expensive experiment ever built. It sits in a 27-kilometre tunnel that spans the border between Switzerland and France, and it will create conditions not seen in the universe since a fraction of a second after the Big Bang. As anyone who has been taking even a passing interest in the show will know, we're talking about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, and finally we know when it will be switched on. The big day is the 10th of September. I asked theoretical physicist John Ellis how it feels that the waiting is almost over.
Well, I think it's the most exciting moment in my career as a physicist, and I've seen plenty of accelerators come and go. Really, the LHC takes us to places that we've never been before. It's the most powerful microscope for examining the structure of matter by an order of magnitude compared with what we've had before. And we're pretty damn sure there's something there, but we don't know exactly what it is. So we don't know what we're going to find. The LHC will tell us. It's going to tell us pretty damn soon.
Clearly, we're not going to be finding the Higgs boson on day one, on the switch-on day on the 10th of September. What will actually happen on that day?
So pretty much as we speak right now, they're trying to get the LHC to talk to the lower energy accelerators. So particles are... accelerated in a series of steps, each one in a larger accelerator, and then our highest current accelerator, the SPS, we have to get particles from there into the LHC. Now, initially, it's just a question of getting them, if you like, to handshake, but not actually trying to get the particles to go around. Then what we expect is that on the 10th of September, for the first time, we'll be able to try to send particles all the way around the 27 kilometres of the LHC ring.
When do you think it would be sort of correct to say that the LHC is working at its full capacity? How long do you think that will take?
Well, the full capacity is supposed to be 7,000 GeV, i.e. 7 TeV colliding with 7. That will not happen until next year. Also, the full capacity is supposed to be a decent rate of collisions. We're not expecting a big rate of collisions initially this year, probably rather few collisions in total. So it's not exactly clear, you know, what you mean by operating at full capacity. But for me, you know, what's going to happen later on this year, will certainly be a giant step forward.
But once the LHC really starts churning out data sometime next year when the collision rate goes up, what are you most looking forward to trying to find in that data?
Well, I would say the two headline items are obviously to find the Higgs boson, but that might take a bit of time. The other thing, obviously, is to look for some sort of physics beyond the standard model. Now, my favorite candidate for that is something that provides the dark matter in the universe. So the cosmologists tell us that something like 80% of the matter in the universe is some invisible stuff that's presumably not made of the same protons, neutrons, and electrons as what we are made of. So presumably some different type of particle, and in many theories, that different type of particle is light enough to be fabricated at the LHC. Now, we could be very lucky, and it could be that very soon after the switch on of the LHC, presumably not this year, but next year at least, one could actually start producing and observing that stuff. But it could be that it's much more difficult to find. It's just difficult to tell.
That was John Ellis at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Bill, this is another kind of disaster that people often talk about, that CERN is going to, you know, precipitate the end of the universe. Is that true?
I hope not, to be honest. I'd rather, you know, if we're going to go at all, I'd rather we went slowly than with an extremely large bang. But what I was going to say is that one of the increasingly convoluted arguments used by the increasingly small number of climate skeptics is that we are too small and our activities are too irrelevant to actually have any impact on the whole of the world's atmosphere. Well, here we are as a race creating conditions that have never existed, as far as we know, since the Big Bang. Now, you know, we must be pretty reasonable at impacting nature if we can do that sort of thing. So to suggest that we're too small to affect the climate is just clearly utter nonsense.
Well, to read more about those conditions that haven't existed since the fraction of a second after the Big Bang, you can read more about the project, including pieces by Sir Martin Rees, Stephen Hawking, A.C. Grayling and Chris Morris, at guardian.co.uk/science/CERN. Well, time is nearly up for this week's show, but before I come back to our guest, Bill Maguire, some thoughts from the fount of wisdom that is the Guardian Science blog. On last week's show, we were speaking to the neuroethicist Julian Savulescu about the rights and wrongs of drug use in sport. Here's what Fitz Online had to say.
Athletes who use performance-enhancing drugs are still limited to their biological potential, but are able to achieve and maintain that potential with less effort. It's obviously naive to think of sport as separate from politics, but I'd still like to think of it as one area where anyone with the potential to achieve greatness can do so based on their own determination. I've always been a fan of the underdog, and I'd like to think that they'll always have a sporting chance.
Well, it looks like this room full of doped-up podders has nearly made it to the end of another show, but first a quick word again with our guest, Bill Maguire. One thing about climate change is that the problem, the potential disaster down the road, is so huge, so kind of mind-numbingly scary, and yet the solutions in terms of what individuals can do, changing your light bulb, even not taking that easy jet flight, seems so insignificant by comparison. There's this kind of huge chasm between the two. And also, you might say, actually, if I personally just change my light bulbs for low-energy light bulbs, it won't actually make a blind bit of difference unless lots and lots and lots of other people do it. How do we sort of bridge that gap?
Well, you're right. There is a big disconnect. And two things, really. First of all, you know, we are all responsible for climate change, certainly in the developed countries. And if we're going to have an impact on reducing emissions, we all need to take responsibility and take action from, you know, as individuals, right the way up to governments, international agencies. And as a single individual, there's not much we can do. But if you multiply all the changes in your house, for example, to reduce your carbon footprint by the 20 million families in Britain, that makes a big difference. And if you multiply them by the 300 million people plus in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. So individuals acting in concert can make a big difference. And they can also, if they don't like the way the government's responding to climate change, the climate change challenge, you can just kick them out. So, you know, we have a lot of power.
David, do you think ultimately it has to be top down, really, to really make things happen?
I've always believed this, that you need the government to pull the big levers. Because there's a certain amount of power which is beyond our control as individuals. So I'm thinking about energy policy and that kind of stuff. But I think, I mean, Bill's right in a sense, because governments only act if they think they're not going to get voted out. And so if there's collective action, it helps them, and that helps the situation internationally. And people do lots of little actions in different parts of their life all the time. The number of people I see running on the treadmill in the gym, you know, you can say, well, that does bugger all to your health at all, you know, running once on the treadmill. But you do it every day, you do other things as well, lots of other people do. And so it's a little bit disingenuous, I think, to say that, oh, this action is too small to make any difference. Because if it's so small, well, just do it anyway.
That, I think, is a good place to leave it. Thanks very much, folks. Gold medals to Ian Sample, Marcus Pierce, David Adam, and our guest, Bill Maguire. Science Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm James Randerson. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.